Well, since the origin of humankind, there have been sightings of Yeti, Bigfoot, Sasquatch all over this planet. And a number of dedicated scientists and researchers have tried to get the answer to just what could this creature be, if anything. As a matter of fact, a long time ago, we were given this sound clip of what someone says was a Bigfoot. Who knows what that is? Just last week, a person in North Carolina took a 7-second video of something lumbering across the highway down there, and he claims it was a Bigfoot. You could see something. It was a creature, but it also could have been somebody in a costume. At coasttocoastam.com, under our Insta poll there, you'll see on the highlight page a poll going on about Bigfoot, where 52% of you right now still believe that it is a yet unidentified flesh and blood creature that simply has evaded capture. You can go ahead and cast your vote there as well. Tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we will have three special guests for you throughout the night. We will be taking your calls all evening long and your stories. Up next, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum joins us. Sasquatch, legend meets science. On Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jeff Meldrum is an associate professor of anatomy and anthropology at Idaho State University. He's also an affiliate curator of vertebrate paleontology at Idaho Museum of Natural History. Dr. Meldrum has been investigating the ways monkeys, apes, and human ancestors get around. He's a regular on Coast to Coast AM. His book, Sasquatch, Legend Meets Science. He's with us this hour on Coast to Coast, Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Jeff, welcome back. How are you?
Thanks, Barry. I'm doing very well, George. Thanks.
Good. It's good to have you here. So many sightings of Bigfoot, some with video, some with not. They look like guys in costumes to me, Jeff. The most recent one I saw out of North Carolina looks like some guy lumbering across the road in a suit. I don't know. What's your take on some of those?
I'd have to agree with you on that. That happened over the spring break, so I was out of touch with the world for a few days, taking a little respite. But when I got back to the office, I was very underwhelmed by the quality of the video and the lack of reaction to it, which was a pretty good measure of its quality.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I guess the only silver lining to that type of thing is that it stands in such marked contrast to the quality of something like the Patterson-Gimlin film. And once more, it reiterates to those who would say that film is just a man in a fursuit. Well, compare it to something which is obviously just a man in a fursuit, and it's not so obvious to those who have a little understanding of anatomy and locomotion and obviously the history of this phenomenon.
I remember in school, Jeff, I was looking at a book, reading about the abominable snowman. Yeti, and I couldn't put it down. I was just fascinated by it, and I really didn't know much about Bigfoot or Sasquatch in this country. I was just a little kid, I kept reading about the abominable snowman, what's going on in the Himalayas, right. And then a few years later, I began to hear stories about Bigfoot here and Sasquatch here,
right.
And I, even at that young age, said, this has got to be the same species, the same kind of creature. That is all over this planet. What got you in this direction? What got you interested in this field?
Well, I kind of grew up on the tail end of that Himalayan craze and the fascination with the folklore surrounding the Yeti and the reports by mountaineers of footprints and sightings and so forth. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I eventually was introduced to the Sasquatch, to the North American Bigfoot. And in fact, Roger Patterson came up through Spokane, where I lived as a youngster, and showed his documentary that showcased the film clip from Northern California. And it certainly made an impression on me at that time and steeled my interest that was already growing in the direction of questions of human origins and cavemen and all things prehistoric, as many youngsters are fascinated with at one time or another. So that was my first introduction to it. But from a more professional level, I think we've talked in the past about my encounters with footprints in the field, and first in southeastern Washington, in the Blue Mountains outside of Walla Walla, Washington. And I tell you, seeing fresh, extremely fresh footprints for that first time was really, I can only describe it as a life-changing experience. But it certainly has changed the direction of my professional career of the past 18 years now, more or less. And it's hard when seeing that kind of evidence up close and firsthand to just simply turn away and walk away from it. And so I've been poking at this question from various angles now for quite a number of years.
And I'm sure we're going to get some phone calls this hour, Jeffrey, from people who have had incredible eyewitness testimony of these
right.
creatures. I mean, we've heard stories of baby Bigfoot throwing rocks at houses and all kinds of things. I mean, there's something going on. If you had to estimate how many of these creatures might be roaming just the United States region, mm-hmm. North America, what would you say?
Right.
A couple thousand, maybe?
I think tops. I think that they must be very, very rare and dispersed throughout their habitat with large home ranges and not significant concentrations by any means. I mean, the footprint evidence doesn't seem to support that. It suggests, no more than a handful of individuals in quite a large area, 1,000 square miles perhaps. But obviously we're guessing. They're educated guesses based on the implications of the amount of footprint evidence that we have and the frequency of encounters, reports of sightings and encounters. But I think given the elusiveness and the reclusiveness of these things, they must be very, very few in number.
Where would you rate them in terms of intelligence? We've got, chimpanzees, apes. We've got human beings. Would you put Sasquatch in the middle? Are they up there on the higher plane of intelligence? Where do you think they are?
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion, and sometimes it's not based on real objective experiences, which makes it difficult. Some individuals have had very subjective personal experiences that cause them to conclude that they are very human-like in their intelligence, or as you say, even existing on something of a higher plane of existence with extrasensory perception and the ability to communicate telepathically and so forth. My own personal experience, and that's the only thing that I can base my conclusions on at this point, in the absence of more objective evidence on the part of people who think that way, the evidence doesn't suggest something that human-like. When the genus Homo, of which we belong, we're one mm-hmm. species, when it first emerged 2.5 million years ago with the earliest species of Homo, like Homo habilis and Homo rudolfensis and so forth, the fossil record of skeletal remains was also accompanied by archaeological remains, the use of tools, stone tools that have persisted in the archaeological record, and other even more complex and sophisticated tools as the evolution of the human ancestry progressed. And with Sasquatch, we don't have any evidence of repeated tool use other than the types of things that you might see in the behavioral repertoire of other great apes, the opportunistic brandishing of sticks or throwing of stones. They don't seem to have permanent shelters other than occasional nests that are reported by some witnesses, similar to the type of vegetation nests that gorillas would make on the ground or chimpanzees up in the trees and so on. And so I'd have to say that the evidence for me points to something that's on par with a great ape. Now, there certainly is some room between the brain size and correlated intelligence of a chimpanzee or a gorilla orangutan sure. and modern humans. And so, you know, it could fall somewhere in between there, maybe a little smarter than a gorilla or a chimpanzee. But honestly, I haven't seen any evidence to really suggest that. All their behaviors can readily find a correlate amongst those that have been reported for other primates, other great apes.
And I'll tell you, Jeffrey, what I find fascinating, I don't hear many stories of these creatures, these purported creatures, being violent, attacking human beings. They don't seem to do that.
Right. Well, yes, I think by far and away that seems to be the case. And it's interesting that the very few reports that the historical reports where such behavior is indicated, it's usually a case of the humans showing aggression first, mm-hmm. taking shots at them. You know, like so the apes of Ape Canyon, the Mount St. Helens, the miners shot at one, and possibly killed one. The Roosevelt story of Bauman up in the Bitterroot Mountains, they took shots at this creature that interloped into their camp and claimed that they hit it at one point, given the screams that it emitted at the time. And so, you know, that type of behavior isn't surprising really at all. You know, but then having said that, there have been some reports, Native Americans have traditions of them snatching children on occasion. And, you know, the whole Tsonequa tradition is that of a cannibal giantess that snatches up wayward children who are out past their curfew or in the woods alone and pitching them into a basket on her back and taking them home for supper, kind of like Hansel and Gretel. And they often escape. Usually they escape, but you know, one of my close friends here that's a tribal member here in Idaho grew up down in Nevada, and they had stories of infants being snatched from the teepees during extremely hard winters. You know, and it may sound like a just-so story, but yet recently we've learned of documented cases in Africa where the drought conditions have driven the chimpanzee populations there to seek food in perhaps less conventional ways, and that's included snatching human children. And there was a period of about 7 months when there were 12 reports of human children being snatched by chimpanzees and killed and partially eaten. So it's interesting. I mean, I find that fascinating. It's a very unfortunate.
We know chimpanzees can be very violent.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so an animal of this size, under stressful conditions, may seek food wherever it's available. And if it's a little bundle of a child, then that's not out of the question, given the precedent that we have in other great apes' behavior. So these native traditions may actually be based on an incident, maybe a rare one, hopefully, presumably, but yet it was obviously traumatic enough that it became ingrained in their traditional stories and oral folklore.
You're a scientist. You're an anthropologist. You wrote a book called Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. What did that do for the field?
Well, my hope was that it would lay out sort of a baseline of what we know within a scientific context. I mean, what is the framework? For example, the instance that we just talked about. You know, can we place some of the behaviors that have been attributed to Sasquatch, some which seem to be odd and out of place for a primate, like living in a temperate climate or eating fish, which had never been reported for great apes until just a couple of years ago. Those types of things. Can we place them in a context and evaluate that evidence in an objective fashion? You know, is there an ecological context? Is there a possible body of evidence, of objective evidence, in the form of footprints and hair that point to a consistent but as yet unrecognized entity out there in the environment? And I must say that I've found that it's been a very useful tool with my colleagues and with agency personnel. We've taken gone to great pains to establish networks and contacts with U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents and foresters and state game and fish person now, and the book has been a very good tool to introduce them to the objective evidence that is there. Some of it inferential, some of it somewhat speculative and theoretical, but also the baseline of what we have in, at hand and how we might go about pursuing that definitive evidence. So I think it has made a very positive impact in that regard, and together with other, I mean, there's certainly other important contributions. Dr. Bindernagel, for example, has penned a couple of very useful books that have addressed the primate nature of this phenomenon, as well as the reluctance of the scientific community to acknowledge past discovery of this creature, but yet the ongoing resistance to recognize and acknowledge that event.
Jeffrey, why can't we physically get one? I don't think we should be shooting them or anything, right. But we don't find the dead carcass. We don't find we can't get them. How come?
Well, there's no short answer. There's when it comes to the question of carcasses and bones, you know, it's a vexing circumstance. It's a challenging lack of evidence. But when you consider it again within the context of what we know, the precedents for other animals that are living in wet coniferous forested habitats, and particularly in the Pacific Northwest, where the soils are often very acidic due to the volcanic elements within those soils and sediments, the preservation of bone is very rare. Fossilization just doesn't occur very frequently. About the only place you find fossils are in lake and river deposits or in cave deposits where there's an alkaline environment that's more conducive to the preservation of bone. But out in exposed to the elements and exposed to the scavengers, they're very quickly processed. Then when you consider the natural history, the nature of the creature, the fact that it is very rare, that it is long-lived, it reproduces infrequently. I mean, these are inferences that we're drawing based on an assumption that this is a large primate. And so extrapolating from other aspects of the life history of primates, we can safely assume that. Then a death, given their size, they're at the top of their food chain, they have no natural predators, perhaps other than humans. If they survive infancy, they'll live to a ripe old age. So a death amongst this very rare population of, you know, very small population, is a very rare event. And, you know, when you think about the number of other types of wildlife, much more common wildlife, like deer, tens of thousands of deer die annually over winter. And yet, when we go out hiking, how many carcasses and skeletons of deer do you stumble on in the woods? Precious few, because they get scattered and recycled very, very rapidly.
Pulled off, eaten away, and things like that.
Well, exactly.
That is a good point. You know, there's some fraud in this field, as there is in just about anything. That's got to tick you off, Jeffrey. It does me sometimes.
Well, it does. You know, it's frustrating because it's very easy for the critics and the skeptics to become fixated on the poor evidence, the frauds and the hoaxes, and just the poor interpretations of some individuals, and so that makes it all the more important to put more credible, more objective, more accurate evidence in their hand. And again, that's, you know, one source has been.
Well, we're going to take phone calls, Jeffrey, with you when we come right back. And I want to talk more about what you're working on. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we had our chat today with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, author, dream expert. And for just 25 cents a day, you can do the same thing by being a Coast Insider. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and learn all about it. Coast Insiders, of course, formerly called Streamlink members. And we'll be back in a moment. We'll take your calls and continue our discussion this hour with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. And each hour, a new guest will come in as we talk about Bigfoot and Sasquatch on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum this hour as we talk about Sasquatch, his book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. Jeffrey, what are you working on now these days?
Well, in the lab, we're continuing with various analyses of the footprints. We have created a virtual archive with most of the specimens that are in my lab, and although the site's still under construction, it is accessible through the Idaho Museum of Natural History webpage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to, you know, form the basis for more quantitative studies to compare the footprints and with data from other hominid fossil footprints and analyses of human footprints, etc. And then I have a student who's been working with me trying to bring up to date the analysis, the morphological analysis of the hair samples that continue to accumulate in our lab here. And now that Dr. Fehrenbach has retired, I've encouraged him to kind of throw in his resources and his conclusions, and we're working on a collaborative paper that will be presented at some of the meetings this year, presenting some of the initial findings of the fact that there continue to be hair samples that defy identification, that defy attribution to any common wildlife, and yet clearly show the consistent presence of some primate-like entity out there. So that's great. And then in the field, we're taking a different tack and shifting our emphasis from attempting to get hair and camera traps to the use of search and recovery dogs, who are being a couple of which are being trained specifically for identifying tissue of great apes, primates, and their scat as well. So, with the hope that we can find more scat samples that will let us know more extensively about their eating habits and, you know, what resources in a given area they're using, but then also with the idea of maybe finding some physical remains, some bits of bone or the remnants of a decomposing corpse, as you mentioned, and that could go a long way. You know, a single diagnostic bone or a tooth, a single isolated, could really tip the scales in as far as identifying this creature.
Gorillas sleep generally, what, just right out in the forest, in the jungle? Do they sleep in caves at all? And I'm wondering, where do these creatures sleep?
Right. Well, yes, gorillas typically just create nests in the forest. The larger males are usually on the ground. Sometimes the females will nest up in the canopy, where they can fold branches in and create kind of sometimes a very elaborate hammock of sorts, a platform of vegetation there. We don't really know. It's likely that if these animals here in North America are enduring the winter climate, that they are denning in overhangs or caves or some other type of shelter. But for the most part, during the summer season, what few reports that I'm aware of that make mention of nesting behavior, they're out in the open. They're in just bedding down on mats of vegetation. I have seen one such mat that was very possibly a Sasquatch bed, given the size and the depth of the vegetation that was accumulating, collected in this instance. It looked like it had been accumulated over the winter, and as just a layer of insulation on top of the snowpack.
All right, let's settle in. Let's take some calls here. Ian is in Tampa, Florida, east of the Rockies. We'll get you started. Go ahead, Ian. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Hey, it's a pleasure to speak with both of you tonight.
Sure thing.
My story is from back in the fall of 95. I'm from Oregon, and I was bow hunting with a buddy of mine out south of Hood River, south of Mount Hood area in the Cascade Range.
Mm-hmm.
And we were driving along some mountain area, and we found a spur road that we were going to go down, and we're scouting for elk. And so we drove down. It was real tight road, tight logging road, very overgrown, didn't look like many people had ever been on it in a long time. And when we got to the end of it, it was looking out over a clear-cut valley, and nothing was going on for half an hour. So we turned around, and we were driving the truck back out the road. And I'd say we went about a quarter mile, and it was getting dusk time at that point. And a tree had fallen over the road, and this pine tree was a good maybe 2.5 foot diameter, probably 30 feet tall, maybe a little shorter, but a big tree, a fresh tree, not a dead tree, not a snag. And it looked like it'd been shoved over on the road, on this very narrow road. So we were stuck, but luckily we had a winch on the front of the truck. So I got out and I winched up the tree, and we were able to back up and yank this thing up. We got the worst, creepiest feeling that that tree had been pushed over on purpose by something, and we didn't think it was a bear. We didn't see or hear anything other than that, but it was just freaky. And we got that tree shoved. We moved so fast. Like, we barely even had that tree out of the way. I jumped back in the truck, and we hauled tail out of the mountains. So
that's interesting. You know, how many people are freaked out by these creatures, Jeff?
Well, yes. I mean, it is a commonly reported experience, and you know, we can only speculate on the basis of that kind of a reaction, whether it's just the unexpected, the fear of the unknown, or whether there's something more visceral taking place as a result of some sort of interaction. But I've often spoken with seasoned, hardened outdoorsmen and hunters who, after such an experience, will swear they'll never go back to that spot again, and they don't go out in the woods unarmed any longer. And so you have to wonder what precipitated such a visceral reaction to that kind of a experience.
Let's go to Jerry, truck driving in Texas. Hey, Jerry, you're on the show. Go ahead.
George, good to talk to you guys tonight.
Thanks.
I was going to need to ask your guest there what he thinks about that documentary that was probably made back in the 60s about that tracker that had caught a clip of Bigfoot walking down through a creek bed there before he got out of range. I'm sure he's familiar with a film clip, but I'd like to know what he thinks about that. And there was an experience I had. I was elk hunting up in Montana, kind of southwest of Kalispell out there, and I was sitting in a tree up there and really didn't see anything. I got down and it's dark. And I want to tell you what, George, I felt something looking at me. My adrenaline kicked in. My asthma kicked off. I didn't know if I was going to make it back to the truck. I couldn't get back to that truck quick enough. It scared. I'm a good-sized fella, and it scared me almost death.
Jeez. What is it about these creatures, Jeff, that make people so freaked out?
Well, like I said, we can only speculate. In my book, in the chapter on vocalization, I broach an interesting possibility, and that is that they may be capable of generating infrasound of a high enough intensity that it has a visceral effect on witnesses. There's some, you know, all sorts of interesting literature that talks about the effects of acoustics on the function of organs and the reaction by receptor sites within the brain that can affect mood and psyche and even states of consciousness. So the litany of animal species that have been now documented capable of producing such infrasound in various and utilizing it in various capacities has really grown tremendously. And while there has not been definitive studies conducted on great apes, they certainly have the plumbing in the form of extra laryngeal air sacs that would allow them to potentially generate and project that kind of a infrasonic blast by infrasonic, it wouldn't be perceived audibly, but yet the effects of that vocalization might be perceived in the form of fear or elation or nausea or disorientation, and those are all responses that various witnesses that I've interviewed have at one time or another have made mention of. So, you know, the gentleman asked about a film back in the 60s. I mean, other than the...
Sounds like the Patterson film.
Well, right. I mean, as far as I know, that's the only clip from the 60s. And so if it is the Patterson-Gimlin film, I'm quite convinced that that's the genuine article. You know, we've examined and re-examined from so many different angles and so many different perspectives. And based on the anatomy, based on the nature of the gait, based on the correlated and well-documented footprints and the action of the feet that can be seen in the film itself, I'm quite convinced that's the best photographic evidence and stands as the most compelling piece of visual evidence that these creatures exist.
Do you think the Yeti sightings in the Himalayas and the Sasquatch sightings in North America are the same species?
I don't, because the descriptions of their appearance and their behavior are rather distinct. Although, and the footprints that have been attributed, the very few of the many, many reported footprints that provide enough detail to allow us to assess them suggest a foot that has a divergent big toe, much more like a gorilla or a chimpanzee. Probably the best tracks that have been attributed to the Yeti were documented by the McNeely-Cronin expedition to the Irrawaddy Valley in Nepal, and very well documented, very fresh tracks, and they essentially look like a large chimpanzee. But there have been other tracks that have been found in some of the lower elevations that are remarkably similar to Sasquatch tracks, however. One that I'm fairly confident about, its credibility, was brought back by Josh Gates, the host of Destination Truth. And so, you know, some may say, well, that wasn't anything like a scientific expedition or qualified observers. But I, based on the footprint itself, I can bring out of the drawers in my lab examples of tracks from the Intermountain West that are almost indistinguishable from the track that he brought back. So that suggests that maybe there are two species within the larger Nepal region, that whatever the Sasquatch of North America is, it has its correlate in Asia, in the form of the Chinese Yeren or the Mandeburung in India, or the a Sasquatch-like Yeti form, whatever you want to call it, the Tsute. And I know that there are some who say that Tsute is nothing but a brown bear, and that may well be, but a larger, more Sasquatch equivalent form. And when you go right along the foothills of the Himalayas, up around to the Pamir and the Tian Shan and Altai Mountains in Georgia and Mongolia and over into the Caucasus, there continue to be well-documented instances of footprints that are virtually indistinguishable from those attributed to the Sasquatch in North America. So we suspect that Asia was the source for a North American primate. So it makes sense that species probably had a fairly widely distributed range throughout the forest, the mountainous forests of Eastern Asia, Central and Eastern Asia, and may still linger as relic populations in some of those now isolated areas throughout that region.
All right, let's go to Vicky in Villa, Washington. Hey, Vicky, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Good evening. I have a story that I want to tell. My in-laws live in Bonners Ferry, Idaho, and one day we were up visiting them, and they live out in the country, and they have like 160 acres, and then they bordered national forest land, so there's a lot of property up there. And one night we were sitting around in the house, and we could hear these coyotes fighting with something, And there's, you could hear about six coyotes fighting with this creature. And this creature had the voice like when you guys did the intro of that sound that you thought was a Yeti or Bigfoot. And they were fighting with him, and they were losing. My father-in-law, who is a mountain man, he lived in northern Idaho his whole life, was really freaked out about it and went and got the gun, and he wouldn't let anybody go out of the house. And we all knew that what they were fighting with was not a cougar, and it wasn't a bear, because none of us have ever heard that sound. Well, where my in-laws live, I said Borders Forest Service, they also have found like little caves, or my mother-in-law would go for a walk, and she goes, you know, she would smell really funny stuff. And one time she found like a little small cave where there was grass and hair that she hadn't seen before. And so she would tell us about it, and they had built a pond where some water was, and they have footprints, and they have pictures of the footprints. And so I do believe that maybe there's one living up there. And I just thought I'd tell you guys that.
Yeah.
Oh, my cousin is from Walla Walla, who used to go up into the Blue Mountains and look for Bigfoot. So you probably know who my cousin would be if I mentioned his name.
What's his first name, Vicky?
His first name is Wes.
Wes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely.
There you go. Well, yeah. What is it about the state of Washington where there seem to be so many sightings, Jeffrey?
Well, I think that the core habitat for these creatures that was originally, or has been, continues to be the temperate rainforest of the Pacific Northwest. And by far the greatest extent there from the Olympic Peninsula and throughout the North Cascades and on down, you know, all the way through the Cascades of Oregon and into Northern California, that's the one of the core habitats, which probably supports some of the greatest densities and therefore has the most frequent encounters. Here in the Intermountain West, the reports do tend to be a little less frequent, and I, part of that is just the behavior of the local human population. Idahoans have historically been rather tight-lipped about this subject and not been willing to share their experiences to the degree that other geographical areas, populations in other geographical areas. So, for example, you know, the suggestion that you have photographs from the Bonner's Ferry area would be very interesting to me, because we have very little in the way of footprint evidence from the state of Idaho. I'd love to take a look at those if you can get in touch with me.
All right, get them to Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, and I'll be back in a moment as we talk next with Daniel Perez, author of Bigfoot Encounters Past to Present on Coast to Coast AM.